Starting a company is easy. Growing a company is harder. But selling your company? That's a whole different story. In The Big Exit Show, we lift the curtain of secrecy around selling businesses by learning from ambitious and successful founders who have been on this roller coaster. Our hosts, venture capital investors Johan van Mil, the founding and managing partner of Peak, and Anke Hauskas, the founding and managing partner of NP Hard, will help you on this exciting journey.
Hey Anke, we just had a great talk with Magnus sitting in his cabin in Spain, just I think between the surfing sessions that he has and while he was, and he exited the company, right? Tapwater to the Blue Water Group. And he built a magnificent hardware product, right? Perhaps you can explain a little bit what he does, because I think it's good for our listeners to understand his business, his line of business.
Yeah, so to keep it very simple, he basically created this device that you put on your tap, your faucet tap, to get out of all the plastics. So the water, the drinking water is super clean, so you don't have to buy any bottled water anymore. That was his whole idea. Let's get rid of all the plastic bottles, and get something clean water from your tap.
Yeah, and this guy is a serial entrepreneur, a Swedish guy living in Spain. And of course, in Spain and these kind of countries, this problem with, let's say, clean tap water is a big issue. So he started that company. But I think what was fascinating for me to hear is that even though he started, I think, 7 companies before this, he brought a lot of, let's say, very practical learnings to the show, right? And giving a lot of insight in how to build your team, also how to get funding, but also how to run an exit process, right? Because this guy has done it a few times already. So I think magnificent learnings on that end.
Yeah. And I guess if you've done it before, it will make it easier, I think, to attract the right talent and run these processes more easily. But still, despite all the success in his past, he also had challenges in this new company, not only because it was a hardware company in a completely different market that is maybe less easier to scale, but also in the acquisition process. I don't think, at least from my insights right now, like if you've done it a few times, it's not really getting more easy. Mm-hmm. It's still a lot of work, but the way he talks about it, so calm and knowing that you need to have optionality, like, and build that up over the years. These are the insights that you definitely learn, I think, if you've done it a few times already. So, incredible insights, especially for those who are doing it for the first time.
Yeah, fully agree. Let's dive into the show. Starting a company, that's easy. Keep on growing a company, that's harder. But selling your company, well, that's a whole different story. And in The Big Exit Show, we lift the curtain of secrecy around selling businesses by learning from ambitious and successful founders who've also been on that roller coaster. Our host, Anke, together with me, Johan, and we are from NP Hard, Anke, and I myself are from Peak. We help you on this exciting journey to learn. And in this episode, we have a guest who is actually based in Spain, and now sitting at his mobile cabin. So that's funny to hear, soon to be jumping on the surfboard again, probably. But Magnus Jørn is a serial entrepreneur. He started a lot of companies, also as an investor, but also as a non-exec, and served as a CEO and founder of the company of Tapwater, which was acquired by Blue Water Group. And prior to this, Magnus was a CEO and founder of different companies. For example, he started the company Golden Gecko, which was acquired by DMI in 2014. But also, he was 17 years active as a pioneer with all kinds of mobile services. So he started in total more than 7 companies, including companies as Drift Bolagat, Lecce Mobile, GeoMe, and as mentioned, Tap Mobile, where we're going to zoom in right now. Welcome, Magnus. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Super excited.
Cool. So tell me, how especially about Tapwater, because you started different companies, right? How did you run and how did you came onto the idea of the Tapwater to start it?
So, yes, I mean, I've been extremely fortunate in the past with having several successful startups in the tech space. And after selling Golden Gecko and also Encom VA, that was co-founded with my dad around 2013-2014, I was planning on just being like semi-retiring and just investing and helping other startups. But then as you spend a lot of time with other entrepreneurs and creative people, we constantly came up with ideas. And I got really excited about doing something in the impact space. And particularly because I love the ocean. I love beaches, and I could just see, it was just so sad to see like the amount of plastic and waste that washed up all the time. And also living in Spain since I think 2008 or something like that, I could see that everybody was consuming bottled water. So I got really interested in that topic, and we explored various different business startups. And we thought, okay, if we're going to have the biggest possible impact, we need to get households to stop buying bottled water and replace it with something else. And that's how we came up with the company Tapwater. And as my background is really tech and like human-centric design and so on, we started by just testing lots of products. So we tested over 30 different products that were in the market with consumers. We did trials of different kinds. And after a lot of the tests, we found one that actually seemed to work, and we tested it with 100 people. And this was called Tap One, which was around 2006, 2007. And all the people loved it and said, wow, this is life-changing. Suddenly, I don't have to buy bottled water. So based on this, we decided to start the company, raise a little bit of money, and develop our own products from scratch. And so that was the very beginning. We thought, I mean, and this is one of the challenges, obviously, as entrepreneurs, you have to be crazy optimistic about everything. You have to believe that you can change the world. You have to believe that you can change human behavior and that you can do things that nobody has done before. And we thought, all right, if we launch a product that saves people money, which our products do, so people spend on average in Spain like 300, 350 euros per year on bottled water, they carry home 1,000 kilos of water every year. And with our product, you don't have to carry home any bottled water anymore. It was also starting to become obvious that bottled water is probably not that healthy, considering there's microplastics and hormone disruptors. And then finally, it's bad for the planet. So we thought, okay, if we have 4 strong benefits like this, it's going to be easy. So we projected that we're going to get 100,000 customers within 2 years. That was definitely not the case. I think we probably did hit like 5,000 after a couple of years. But the thing is, changing human behavior is really, really hard. Like, people do not, and we also saw that, like, the eco message, so everybody says that they want to live eco-friendly lives. But in reality, when it comes to the choice of continuing to buy a product that you've been used to buying and changing, it's hard. So yeah, and then the third thing, my background was from software, and producing hardware is really, really hard. Like, you have to design things that are going to be used like 20, 30 times per day with high water pressure, so many different things. They have to be shipped across the world, because actually, like, we wanted to make the products in Europe, but realized it was very hard. So they're developed in China, which means, you know, it takes long lead times to develop, ship, and then get them into your warehouse. And then you realize after a couple of months that there's issues and you have to start over again. So it's been a challenging journey, to say the least, but that's the beginning.
I can imagine, Magnus. Hey, Magnus, you mentioned something really interesting, right? One question, because you mentioned that you want to grow until, let's say, within 2 years to 100,000 appliances sold, right? Mm-hmm. But you raised, you got to 5. Probably you had a few, let's say, really pivotal moments, right? Really a few big breakthroughs which gained traction in your business. Can you mention a few which really stood out in your, let's say, looking back to the growth phase?
I mean, like, it's fascinating, because especially when you're a direct consumer, like, you really do celebrate every win. So like the first sale that came through on our website, we were like, that wasn't influenced by us. We were like, boom, whoa. So our little team of 4 people, everybody was jumping up and down in the office. So that kind of thing happened, I think. And then we celebrated like once we got to 100, and then you celebrate when you get to 1,000. So, but I think one of the really interesting things early on was that we noticed that it was fairly easy to build organic traffic in this space. So about 80% of our sales were actually organic. So that was from our website. The other big thing, pivotal moment, was we launched a product on Amazon. And although it took a couple of months, but it actually quite quickly started to, and this was after, I think, one and a half year or something like that. So that's also where we started to see strong growth. And then a third thing was we realized that actually the sustainability message that we had built the idea around just didn't resonate with consumers. So we changed it to focus on convenience and cost savings. And that made a huge difference in terms of advertising. Like suddenly people went from just clicking to buying the products.
And that probably also changed the way you message the product, like in your SEO
yes.
and the campaigns. Did you also learn that it's a different type of customer
yeah.
that then went on to purchase the product?
Mm. And then another thing that's a pivotal moment is when you have a large enough base to start asking your customers to refer to, like to become sellers themselves, that actually had a really big impact. Because I think we had like 20 to 30% of all new customers came from referrals. And they still do, actually. Mm. So we're still at those numbers. And obviously, that doesn't really help. When you have 100 customers, it just doesn't help much. But when you have 5,000 and 10,000, then suddenly that makes a big impact on an annual basis.
And when you started a company, because you started previous companies which you sold, when you started this company, did you have a certain end goal in mind? Was this company like, I want to bring this IPO, or I want to always keep it private, or I want to sell it, I want to turn this into a lifestyle business at some point? Like, what was the idea when you started this company? Because it's definitely a different kind of company, I think, compared to the previous tech businesses.
So I don't really believe in having like selling the company or being acquired as an end goal. It's like build a great business and whatever you want to do will happen. So that was kind of our end goal. What we did say, though, is that we really wanted to build something that was like before even considering doing something else. We wanted to build a business that was big enough to be like to continue with whomever, like if we sold it, that would kind of sustain itself. Because one of the challenges in specifically in D2C is that, or actually in any business, is that a lot of companies get acquired and then after a year they get shut down because the buyer, like it's just not big enough business for them. So, you know, we considered, for example, okay, if we wanted Unilever to be our buyer or Nestle or someone like that, you know, you have to have significant enough numbers to make it interesting for them, because it has to become a $1 billion business within a few years. Otherwise, it just doesn't make any sense for them to focus on. In that sense, we had really big ambitions from the very beginning, because we knew that we had to get to that stage if we wanted to do something with the big companies. And otherwise, we were like, let's just continue to build this on our own. It took, I mean, if you look at one of, obviously, as being Swedish, one of the inspiring entrepreneurs for me was Ingvar Kamprad, and it took him at least 10 years like before it was really a strong business, before he got beyond the first store. So it's okay that things take time as well, I think. I think as entrepreneurs, we're often very impatient. But in this case, you know, we thought we have time to make it grow.
And maybe to that point, because you've been doing this multiple times, what was definitely helped you, I guess, because you've been going through like growing pains. What is your feeling about, was it easier this time around? Because you had a kind of like a thick skin already?
No, I don't think it ever gets easier. Maybe also because you increase the barrier, like you put bigger and bigger targets on yourself. So it's never going to get easier. But I mean, certain things get easier, like certain things you really get to understand. The importance of having great people, like really, really focusing on hiring and selecting the people. That was a huge focus area for us. And I think that really helped from the very beginning. But then because it was also the first time I did something in hardware, we thought we really tried to bring in specialists in the hardware space. But we found that that's really difficult in Europe, because there's just not many people. Like, we just don't do much consumer hardware. So to find people that have the experience in that space and that have been successful was very, very hard. And that has had a big negative impact on us. So that's the piece that have taken the longest time for us over, like, to get a grasp of, to understand the processes, to make sure that we get the quality in production and all of these things.
And you mentioned on hiring, right? I think it's a big learning that a lot of founders have, right? Especially if they start a second or even third, and in your case, even seventh company, is to hire stronger people. Can you let me double click a little bit on that? What are you looking for? What are, let's say, the key characteristics where you're looking for, but also what are, let's say, the things that you're not looking for? How do you select the right people?
So one thing is the criteria. So I think we have very strong criteria in like that people have proven themselves and being able to be like creative and problem solvers. Like you really want problem solvers because you want people that can solve things on their own, that are not dependent all the time on going to their manager or going to me as the CEO. So that's like examples of that has always been a super critical thing. And both, you know, problem solvers individually and problem solvers as team members. So that's been one of the critical questions that we've asked. This also means that, you know, they could come from a big company background, but also having worked in startups. Like you can really get people from both. But it is a challenge as well. Like the other thing that you see is that if you hire people that have have worked in corporates, they have they're used to having a certain support structure, and it's very difficult for them to adapt in the beginning. So they're used to having professional HR, to have processes in place, to have people that can do everything for them. And when you're in a startup, you want people that can do everything themselves. You also want people in marketing, for example. If you hire people from a bigger company, they're used to having lots of agencies that do all the work. But actually, in a startup, ideally, you want people that are used to hiring freelancers to do individual tasks. So you need to do logo. Oh, great. I get someone on Fiverr. They will do it for $50. Boom. And then next thing, ads. Boom. So those kind of things. The other thing I would say is just about the volume of candidates. So that's been a key learning as well, is that the more candidates, the more interviews you do, the greater quality typically you do get. So we've always been striving to get 100, like minimum 100 and ideally 200 candidates per role before we review them. And we've been lucky enough as well. Like when you're in the space that is a mission impact oriented company, you do get a lot more candidates. Like people today really want to work in these kind of environments. So we definitely get a lot more applicants than you would get if you were just actually compared to an app developer, for example, today, because that's just a very different business.
And I guess also the fact that you've been doing this like a successful serial entrepreneur, it's probably also easier to find great talent. People want to learn from other successful people. So I can imagine that also helped over the years.
That's true. No, that's absolutely true. Yeah. And I think, and then also mixing it up the right way between having a certain seniority of people and just really fresh people that come straight out of university. Lots of interns, like lots of people that are just eager to learn and test. That's also been a good mix.
Good to hear. And then in a certain moment, you started to realize that you needed extra funding, right? You probably invested some of your own money also into the company.
Yeah.
I watched you pitching at NOAA, I think in 2018, yes. Right? With a good pitch for all the investors. Didn't happen to be there, but what was your learning also as an experienced entrepreneur, right, in raising funding those years? Because it was a different time than we are today. Can you elaborate a little bit on that, also to take the founders who are listening right now with your learnings to raise funding for a company like that?
Yeah, this is also like, it's a big difference between like the tech space and what we were trying to do. Since my background was tech and I actually found it quite easy to raise money in that space. Typically, you would pitch to 10 VC funds and you would get two or three that were interested. And then that was it. You didn't have to do more. Or in some cases, they would be contacting you. In our space, that's definitely not what happens. So you know, we had to reach out to about 100 funds. And most of them were simply just limited. They would not invest in anything related to hardware. I would say like 90% will not invest in hardware and even consumers. So it's a lot, like you have to take an enormous amount of rejections. The other problem is that a lot of them were actually interested in talking to us because they really liked our mission. But then it was always the same thing. Sorry, you know, our investment criteria don't actually allow us to invest in this. I tried with my boss. So we realized it also just wastes a lot of your time. So you have to be, so actually one of the key learnings there was make sure that you ask the right questions to the investors as well from the beginning, you know, like don't, if you don't invest in the space, that I understand, but, and don't waste our time. And also the other thing was ask, like, because a lot of the people were open to talking to us, we asked them, like, who do you know? So actually, that's how we, in the end, ended up getting Blue Water as an investor, and also Jabeur, our other investor. It was introductions from people that we spoke to, and people are really open about that. Like, if they take the time to speak to you, and you ask them, you know, who else do you know that might be interested? If they're not interested in themselves, typically they're happy to make the intros, and those warm intros, they always respond. So whereas the cold, like when you reach out to VC funds by cold email or their contact forms, maybe, you know, maybe 1 in 3, 1 in 4 response. Whereas if it's an interaction, you will get a response every time. So I think that is a real.
Have you ever considered doing crowdfunding? Like during the 2013, 2014, I was with Pebble, which was like also hardware consumer device. And we went on crowdfunding, which was like first a 10 million round and then 23 million from the community, basically. Was that also, and this was obviously in the US where Kickstarter is a bigger thing than in Europe, but has that been a thought during that period?
Yeah, so we actually did an Indiegogo campaign, I think, but I think we raised 20,000. The limitation was basically that we're based in, like, that we're, our core markets from the beginning was Spain, and that's very limited in terms of that space. But you're right, if it had been in the US, I think there would have been a massive opportunity there. I would have focused a lot more on that.
Yeah.
And the same thing actually also with investors, like angel investors through these kind of platforms, because you can see a lot of customers were interested in investing in us. But again, you're much more likely to be able to raise money through that in the UK or US or Australia in certain markets than maybe in Southern Europe.
Yeah.
And one question, last question, I think on the funding, indeed, because you raised, I think, your Series A with Blue Water Group also at that time.
Yeah.
I mean, you're a very experienced entrepreneur and you probably know all about, let's say, the risk in having a strategic investor early on board, in especially in an exit later in that company. How did you deal with that, especially with that? Because that's for us as a VC always, as you can imagine, right, always an important point to limit that kind of risk.
Yeah, it was actually in this case, it was kind of easy because their investment fund was completely separate from the core business.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't actually really consider that to be a problem. But otherwise, I agree. You know, we had conversations like that where we said, no, we don't want to do it.
Okay. Good to hear. I have a lot of questions on that, but that's, I think, for another occasion. And then let's go to the exit, also looking at the time, right? What was the moment, Magnus, that you started to realize it was about time to sell your business? What was that, let's say, inflection point?
Yeah, so it was actually towards the end of 2022. Part of it was that... So I was not the CEO from the beginning. We actually, because during this time, I had my first kid and then my second kid, and I knew this was going to happen. I really didn't want to run the company again at this time. Like I wanted to have someone else managing the business. And we had a great woman running the team, super good CEO. But after a few years, she's basically said, I want to continue to run this business, but I don't want the pressure of continuing to raise money. I just want to focus on profitability and do it my own way. Mm-hmm. And if you're okay with that, I will continue. If you're not okay with that, then, you know, I'll leave and do something else and let you find someone else to run it. And so that basically meant because our ambitions were really to grow it and do something big. We had, unfortunately, to make a shift there. And then we brought in an external CEO for a year. And then he also, for various reasons, decided to leave. And suddenly there was no one to run it. Like, we could not hire another external CEO again. So then I said, fine, I'll take over. But one of the conditions for this is that we need to find a way of making sure that we have, you know, a stable future, something that works. And the other part, so that was one part. The other consideration was that it's actually a very capital intensive business because of what we said before with hardware. So, for example, if we receive a retail order, so like some stores in Germany buys 10,000 products, then that might mean that we have to make an order to our factory for $300,000-$400,000 US dollars that has to be paid straight away, and we get paid 6 months later. So you have very long payment periods. And this meant we would have to continue to raise money constantly, and VCs are not very keen to fund that kind of business. So it just meant that if we wanted to continue to grow in that segment, we had to find a different type of ownership structure. So those were probably the main two considerations. And then third, actually, was that, you know, we're doing pretty well. We had fairly good numbers, and you never know when something happens. Like, what if there was another COVID that would hit us or something like that? You know, my background, the first startup that I was, like, the first serious startup that I was involved in Sweden, web hosting company, we got offered $100 million for the business in February 2000. And then 1 year later, we gave away the business because our board wanted a little bit more money. So we were a bit greedy. So the other consideration here was that if there's an interested buyer that is willing to pay a price that is acceptable to you and that you feel that the business will continue and there's an upside and all of that, then, you know, sometimes it's just, you just say, great, let's do it. We succeeded. It's fine.
Yeah. And especially in this case, you had the investor also on board, right? How did these talks went? Because I can imagine, right, because they're already an investor. They saw that indeed the first CEO was leaving, who was, let's say, wanting more a profitable business, then the second left and you took it over, right? Mm. Did you, let's say, also reach out to other, let's say, potential buyers on the net? Or was it, let's say, a more...
No, we absolutely... I think you have to, because otherwise you cannot find a price. So we had two other bids that made it possible to find the right price in this conversation. Otherwise, it would not have.
And were you leading the way, or did you work with a corporate M&A, like an external party, doing the work for you?
No, I led the way, because actually during the journey, we had been speaking to so many companies that were interested. It was just a question of, like, was it the right timing? So I think this is also something that you learn maybe after a few startups, is that you want to talk to lots of people during your journey and keep those doors open. So you never say no. You might tell them, not now, but you keep on updating them, and that's what we did. So
this is such an important insight. I think we're hearing this over and over. This is such an important insight that it's not like in the last few weeks before the acquisition. It's basically years of building up relationships and creating optionality. Mm.
And they even knew, I mean, this was the thing, the other companies also knew that there was a pretty big chance that Blue Water would outbid them. So, you know, it was...
Yeah, isn't that the risk? Because I was referring to that also, Magnus, that indeed, let's say, having a strategic investor on board who has the first right always, did you also experience that in, let's say, the sales process, that you had that strategic investor on board? So if somebody else would pay the price, put the price down, then existing investors could bid them out? Was also what your experience on that end?
Yeah, but I mean, in reality, you always have that situation, though, because someone can always outbid you. So in this case...
Agree. Only in this case, they were already right a shareholder, right? So they had that internal insight. Mm. And normally they don't have that internal insight, right?
That's true.
And that first right.
Yeah. No, that's true. No, the question came up. But because the teams within Blue Water were separate, so actually the person that was on our board was not involved in the Blue Water core business. He basically said, I have no insights into the core company. My only goal is to make the most out of this investment. So he did not have any goal at all of acquiring us. So I think that helped, maybe. But yeah, you need to play people right. And also it really helped that we had another VC on board, because they, you know, they were just interested in getting the best deal out of it.
He did.
So that's also, like, you have to position. So Christian from Yabeo was, like, extremely helpful and useful in the process. He was the one that was leading the way together with me, and Blue Water took a very hands-off approach on that.
Can you give us some insights of what he did for others listening to this? Like, this is why this person was super helpful in that process.
I mean, one was he was... he tried to really take the position of a buyer towards me. So, you know, we when we were going through the pitch calls and the presentations, like, he was the one that was criticizing, asking the hard questions, pushing, instead of being the supportive seller. Like, that's great when you have a friendly person that actually really questions you, which means when you go into the meetings, you're well prepared. I think preparation is just so extremely important. And in these situations, it's hard because maybe you only have like three big chances. And if you screw up one or two of those by not being properly prepared, maybe the first one that you go into is the one that would have been the potential buyer, and you were not prepared because you didn't really know what questions they were going to buy, like, you know, what they were going to ask. So I think preparations are extremely important, and that was one of the most helpful things here.
And from my understanding, how long was that process? Was it weeks? Was it months?
I think it was about 3 months to finding, to agreeing on a, so to getting the bids. But then, then it took another 3-4 months to actually close it. And I think that's also something that I've seen in a lot of, like, I've actually seen a lot of startups that have failed and collapsed just because of the timelines, because they didn't consider the fact that you have to have a cash runway that lasts for much longer when you're going through a selling process. And you get into difficult positions when you have VCs that might not want to continue to put in loans and so on. So yeah, but that worked out well in our case. So fastest process I've seen was 3 months. But I think in most cases, they do take much longer, especially when it's corporates.
Okay. Anke, should we go to, let's say, the valuation? Is that an idea?
Yeah.
In September 2023, Blue Water Group announced the acquisition of Tap Water. When assessing this deal for me, there were two things to consider. First, their business model is quite special, as we're talking about consumer hardware product that is issued on a subscription base. The second factor in the deal evaluation is Blue Water's involvement previous to the acquisition, as they participated in both funding rounds of TAP, which might have also had an impact on competitive offers in the M&A process, as they already owned parts of the cap table. But let's look first at previous exits in the consumer water industry to check for the multiples being paid. One example is the acquisition that I think everyone heard of, which is SodaStream, which was acquired by PepsiCo in 2018. The acquisition price was $3.2 billion at an LTM revenue multiple of 5. It has to be noted here that SodaStream recurrency is of higher frequency, so it's not on an annual basis, but more frequent, and it was acquired at a different timing of growth for the company and also with a high brand value attached to it. Another company that was acquired in the water filtering industry was Austin-based Aquasana by A.O. Smith Corporation back in 2016. Aquasana serviced 200,000 clients at the point of acquisition, while the revenue was indicated at $44 million. The acquisition price was $87 million, hence a 2x revenue multiple for this acquisition. TAP mentions on their website that they serve around 100,000 customers, which, if we assume the average spend per year is 90 euros based on their product pricing that I could find, would bring the annual revenue to 9 million euros. Applying a revenue multiple of 2.5 to that, the exit valuation of TAP would be 22.5 million euros. Second and next point for valuation estimation is the investment of Blue Water Group into TAP in 2021 with 2.6 million. When you apply a 20% dilution at that point, the company would have been valued at 13 million post money back then. Given a 60% increase in valuation 2 years later, with comfortable growth at the point of exit, this would bring the valuation to about 21 million euros. Therefore, my estimation for the exit would be between 20 million and 22 million euros. And I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on it.
So if it had been in 2021, you would have been spot on, because we actually had, like, we had offers exactly around that that number. But because it was 2023, the numbers, the final number is a bit lower, but it's not, you know, it's not too far off. So I think the big thing that happened, and this is obviously a lot about timing. So the D2C space had a big drop in valuations generally, 2022, 2023. And then the just the general investment climate valuations went down. So. But I think that's like, it's the kind of things that you can't do anything about. You just have to accept that valuations are independent of what you do. Sometimes they're too high, sometimes they're too low. They're never.
You always know afterwards, right?
Exactly. But yeah, that's a good, it's a good, good estimates and valuation of the business.
Good to hear. Thank you for that.
And maybe to that point, when you're talking about like timing, momentum, some things are out of your hand, there's also so much luck involved, I guess. Just when we were talking previously about like COVID, like who could have expected that to happen. Looking back now, after all these companies that you started, and to our listeners, could you share one or two key insights that you learned throughout the years for those who are in that trajectory of thinking maybe about a potential exit?
I do think that it's really important in your head to have some kind of goal. So you might not want to communicate it to anyone, but you should at least know yourself, like, what will make you happy if you receive an offer? Because also because of the fact that, you know, something could happen, like in the case, so in one of my first startups where, I mean, in retrospect, now I was a small shareholder in it, so I didn't have the influence of the business. But the point is, I think it's great just to have, like, to have that figure in mind, because, yeah, what would make you satisfied? And then maybe if you get the offer, even if it comes before you had planned on, it can be life-changing for you. If you're 30, 35, you know, that it can really create a base for the rest of your life. But it can also be that you don't care. Like, money is not important for you. And if it's not, then just keep on going. Like, why exit if you love what you're doing? So I think it's really important to put these things into perspective. You know, I've had a philosophy that I want to change my career completely every 10 years. I want to do something completely different. And, you know, I know that if I had done something in the tech space, I'm sure I would have been much, like, the chances of success would have been much greater and the valuations are much higher and so on. But I wouldn't have learned as much as I did in this case. Like, I learned so much more by doing something completely different. And also going into a space where not many people want to do with things. Like, there's just not, like, to invest a lot of money into this space, that is, it's hard to change human behavior. It's hard to develop hardware. There's so many things. So I think we also need people maybe that have been successful in the tech space to go into completely different businesses and try things that that people might not want to do, from, like, they're much higher risk, but on the other hand, the reward in terms of the impact that you can have on the world is much greater as well.
Yeah, the crazy ones. Maybe as last question from my end, especially when you're talking about, like, maybe every decade you want to do something else, and I looked up your 2023 predictions, waiting now for the 2024 predictions from your end. What is next for you?
So right now I'm really focused on, like, as part of becoming part of Blue Water Group, I have a commitment to continue to run the company for the next couple of years. So I'm completely focused on that. But, you know, I do see enormous opportunities in the AI space, of course, like everybody does, especially in changing old businesses. So maybe not, like, so much of the AI space is focused on new exciting stuff. Where I see the opportunities are, how can you change, like, businesses that are 30, 40 years old in the industrial space, family business and so on, like, especially in Europe, because we need to become more competitive. Like, there's such an opportunity to improve things in Europe. So that's probably where I would look, but I have not decided on anything at the moment.
Very interesting. Totally with you. Johan?
No, it would be great to have you indeed, after your next decade of experience, have you again on the show, right? Probably with a great exit, a great story like we heard today. So really, thanks for your time, Magnus. Really, really enjoyed talking to you. And thanks for giving all the insights to our listeners, right? Especially in, from an experienced entrepreneur, is that you are learning every day and still practicing, as I think we always like to do things like rehearsing pitches, like, etc. So really great to hear these kind of insights, Magnus.
Thank you very much. I loved your questions, and thank you for having me on your show.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Enjoy. I hope you jump in the water later today, but probably you do, right? Yes. If I understand you correctly.
Okay, enjoy. Not a bad life. Yeah.
Okay, thanks a lot. Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Big Exit Show. We hope you enjoyed today. If so, please subscribe to our show on Spotify or your favorite podcast platform. If you have feedback or suggestions for guests that you want to see on the show, please send us a message to podcast@peak.capital. Thanks again for listening, and hope you join us for the next episode.